Blog Talk Radio.
Studies available on Prolific.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Blue Bloods podcast. Tonight, my guest is Jim Gottstein, author of the Zyprexa papers, and Jim's an attorney. He does a lot of work and advocacy for psychiatric survivors, and I want to thank you for that, Jim. I did want to give you a special thanks for your advocacy. It's a highly specialized area of work that you do, and I'm just honored to have you with us tonight, and you can talk about you being a whistleblower with the Zyprexa papers in Lilly. So I'm excited to hear what you have to say. Welcome.
Thanks, Robin. I'm pleased to be here. Basically, I feel so lucky that I wasn't made permanently mentally ill by the system that, I felt like I feel like I need to give back a little bit and help people escape the horrible fate that so many face when they get sucked up into the mental health system.
I feel the same way because I'm like, I don't really have a dog in this fight, but I feel obligated once we know we have an obligation to warn other people to try to save them from the same fate. Because it can happen
right.
to anybody, really.
Yeah, that's right. And, well, I was almost 30 when it happened to me, and I had no idea that, my thinking could just get so screwed up. And then once, I learned how to kind of deal with it and keep from having it happen again. But again, I was lucky. And one of the reasons why it's so important is to try and help people not be forced to take these drugs is that the current mental health system for people in the public mental health system has a, of course, they give these psych drugs, usually neuroleptics, that are mislabeled as antipsychotics, even though they don't have antipsychotic principles for most, a recovery rate of around 5%. And what's
wow.
been shown is if you try really hard to avoid giving people neuroleptics in the first place, you can achieve a recovery rate of 80%. So, and then what it's been found that once people have been put on these drugs, have been on them for a while and they get off of them, they have a 40% chance of recovering. So while that's, eight times better than 5%, it's half of what could be achieved. And so that's why it's so important to try and prevent people from getting put on them. And, of course, people are forced to take these drugs. And when they say these drugs are harmful, a lot of times the people being forced to take the drugs actually know more than the psychiatrists that are forcing it.
Oh, definitely.
But, and so when they say these drugs are harmful, they don't really help, then that's, that's pointed to as a symptom that they're mentally ill.
They're being non-compliant.
Right. And the other thing is that these drugs reduce people's lifespans dramatically, 20 to 25 years. And so,
yeah.
This is allowed to go on just shows how little this group of people are cared for. That this group of people die 20 to 25 years earlier obviously is an acceptable outcome to society.
Have you thought maybe they planned it that way, though? Because when that dawned on me, I've taken Seroquel, and to me that's a lethal medication, but it made me think maybe they wanted to damage our brains and make us die 25 years earlier. Maybe that was the plan all along, like a
plan. Yeah, I've always tried not to ascribe bad motives to people, and that, you know, I mean, that doesn't apply to the drug companies, mm-hmm. but, you know, that the people in the mental the people in the mental health profession, you know, I think, you know, generally have just been, you know, try to do the best thing and have been misled. But that seems increasingly hard to maintain because there's so much information about how harmful and counterproductive they are. So in 2006, when Dr. David Eagleman called me out of the blue saying he wanted to know if I would subpoena him for secret documents showing that Zyprexa caused diabetes and other metabolic problems and were being illegally marketed to children and the elderly. Yeah, I jumped at the chance. And so, and that's, you know, that's the Zyprexa papers. And there was a secrecy order, and he was an expert witness in the this big multi-district litigation. People think of it as a class action, but it's not really. It's where 30,000 cases were consolidated into one case for discovery and settlement purposes. And discovery is where, you know, the parties have to exchange documents and take depositions and things like that. And so this expert was working for one of the plaintiff's firms and had been given access to all this information, secret information, and he thought it was so important for public, you know, to be publicly disclosed that he called me. And the secrecy order said that Eli Lilly, the manufacturer, had to be given notice and a reasonable opportunity to object before Dr. Eagleman could, you know, produce them, give them to me. And I figured that Lilly would, you know, immediately object, and, you know, then I'd be in court trying to prove why my client, Bill Bigley, was entitled to have these documents because he was being forced to take psychiatric drugs. So, I mean, there's, so within, I don't know, three, well, actually, he called me at the end of November 2006. On, I think, December 17th, the first of a series of New York Times front page stories appeared, and it was off to the races. With it was kind of amazing the way Lilly could whistle up these federal judges to order me about, but I had gotten them out. I'd given them to a number of other people besides the New York Times, and they had gotten out on the internet through BitTorrent or something, Tor, I guess. And so it was kind of a precursor to WikiLeaks, and so it created a big furor, and I was in front of the legendary Judge Jack Weinstein in the Eastern District, the United States District Court for the Eastern District of New York, exactly a month later. And he ultimately decided that I had conspired to steal these documents. Steal is, of course, a legal term. And Eli Lilly had been threatening me with criminal contempt and to try and get me disbarred, and that opinion by Judge Weinstein didn't really help any. So, you know, I write about that. There's a lot of stuff in the – a lot of, I think, interesting things in the book, and including one of the things I try and do is bust the myth that people don't get better, don't recover from, you know, so-called schizophrenia after they've been diagnosed with schizophrenia and stuff. So there were a number of people involved in the whole affair that really tremendous people that were diagnosed with serious mental illness when they were younger and got past it and on to do really great things, like Ted Chabaczynski, who was experimented on with electroshock when he was a little boy, David Oakes, who went on to found Mind Freedom, Judy Chamberlain and Laura Ziegler and other people, Will Hall, because I tried to kind of subtly give that message in the book. And the other main thing was my representation of Bill Bigley, who had, his life had just been ruined by psychiatry. He was, and it was really poignant for me because he was just a couple months older than me, and he had been put into the hospital 2 months before I was, 2 years before I was. He had the same psychiatrist, only briefly though, that saved my life, who said that his prognosis was guarded depending on how much help he would be given with his recent divorce and loss of his children, and which of course he didn't get any. And he had a good job.
And that's a traumatic loss in itself, you know, for the foster kids and the parents. When there's a separation of that cut within the family, that's not something you ever really get over. That's lifelong trauma. And they're medicating foster children. No, and you won't.
Right.
I mean, how could you?
That's another thing.
I'm sorry, I had to interject that, you know.
Yeah, that's good. Well, he never got over it. And he ended up being hospitalized about 100 times. And
wow.
Drugged against his will. And a big part, I don't know, at least a third of the book is about my representation of him and trying to prevent that from happening and all that. So that's the book, the Zyprexa Papers. It's available, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore can get it. It's on Kindle. There's an audio book version of it. There's information about it at thezyprexapapers.com, thezyprexapapers.com. And I, I'm pretty proud of it. Some people, more than a few say it's, they found it hard to put down.
It's excellent. You should be proud of it. I mean, David Healy quoted that quote from David Healy. Let me read it. It's beautiful. The Zyprexa Papers should be a must-watch movie, but Hollywood, too scared to take on pharma and too dismissive of mental illness to take on this Aaron Brockovich story. So you'll just have to read about it by the book. That's Dr. David Healy.
Yeah, he was very kind.
He had excellent reviews. You know, I did share some of your reviews on Twitter, and people really were interested on Twitter. They were reading and retweeting a lot of people want to know this. They don't know this and they need to hear it from professionals because I'm not an attorney. I'm not really an expert. I kind of assign myself as an expert, but I always refer to you guys to back up what I'm trying to say in layman's terms. Because, we need the experts. That validates our lived experience as psychiatric survivors.
Right.
You know what
and
I'm saying?
I always refer to, papers published in mainstream, journals. And I rely very heavily, if not almost exclusively, on the work of Robert Whittaker, who wrote Mad in America and Anatomy of an Epidemic, and I've gotten to know him some. And we've uploaded to psychrights.org, psychrights.org, all of the papers he cited in Mad in America. And also, we have psychrights at psychrights.org. There's a what's called the Force Drugging Defense Package, where we have kind of a generic motion opposing forced drugging. And then an affidavit from Bob Whitaker, Robert Whitaker, and Dr. Peter Gercha, who wrote Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial, and Dr. Grace Jackson, who is fabulous, and Lauren Mosier, who was the chief of schizophrenia research at the National Institute of Mental Health, said was the most knowledgeable about how these drugs actually work, or affect people's brains. So there are affidavits in this forced drugging defense package, and the idea is that people can use this to defend against being drugged against their will, because the lawyers that are assigned to them generally don't do squat.
Right, I know. But what about a mental health directive? Is that the same kind of thing? Like when I was on P&A's council, they came up with the mental health directive. I don't know if you've heard of that or not. You probably have, but I don't know if they uphold them when you go into the psych unit. It's basically you can say, I don't want Haldol. I don't want, Thorazine, the drugs that you don't want. And that's your advanced directive.
Well, it's interesting, and of course it varies by state. And I probably shouldn't say this because people want me to do it. But, as a lawyer, I've had some success in stopping people from getting drugged against their will. But I've also been appointed as someone's substitute decision maker a few times. And in some ways, that's more powerful even than being the lawyer. But even then, I'd say it only worked about half the time. And the hospitals tend to ignore them. I mean, for one thing,
right,
they don't really know what to do with people that if they can't drug them.
Right.
That's,
or seclusion. So, I know they use restraints and seclusion a lot, too.
Right.
I mean, I hope they don't use it a lot, but I've seen it. I mean, I only was in a psych unit for a couple of days, but that's long. I mean, one day is too long, but you see a lot. I felt like one flew over the cuckoo's nest. You said this would be a good movie. I felt like, oh, yeah, I'll just observe everything and then tell on them and get everybody in trouble once I get out of here. But it was kind of like a chemical lobotomy because they cold turkey me off Paxil and Ativan, which the whole reason I went was because they said you can't stop Ativan without convulsions. And they cold turkey me and put me on a trial for Topamax. And I couldn't even remember my address when I left there. It was that bad. They totally wiped my brain out.
Well,
and everything, you talked about a bad life. Everything it was bad. Bad.
Yeah, well, that's what they consider working if you're made a zombie. I mean, the neuroleptics, I used to say they were chemical straitjackets, but then I found out basically through Whitaker that they block 70 to 90% of the dopamine transmission in the frontal lobes. And so they're actually chemical lobotomies.
Well, yeah, when you cold turkey somebody off long-term use of Paxil and 8 milligrams a day of Ativan, you cold turkey them off and then throw them on Topamax, which was for seizures. I mean, please. That was like, oh, my God, I'm lucky I ever spoke again. It was horrible. And then the courts came after me for my child. That's when they come for you. And they know you're in there. They can get those. It's horrible what they do to people. So that's kind of how I got involved. That was kind of my story in a short little synopsis. But then they can take your child in certain states and not work towards reunification due to your disability. And I'm sure you've seen a lot of those cases because it sounds like that man, is it Bill? Is that his name?
Bill Bigler.
That they used his. He lost his kids over his...
They went with his mother. They went with his mother. So,
oh, okay.
No, they weren't put in, as far as I know. But, foster children and youth, they are just drugged.
Well, mine weren't put in foster care. That wasn't the case. It's just they can use your mental illness to take a child, is what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And they could put them into foster care.
Well, when they take them, that's what they do. And then... usually,
They put her with family. I mean, they're supposed to try to put them with family, but typically they just put them to whoever is willing to take them first. I mean, you know how it goes. It's a horrible system. But that's kind of how I got introduced to the CBS system and psychiatry. And I was so appalled, and I found protection and advocacy. But, you know, they should have taken that case because it would have helped a lot of people. It would have helped a large class of people. But they didn't take individual cases, and I didn't know enough to advocate for myself, you know. And then I finally got it as a goal and stuff, but that's a whole other story. So that's kind of how I got into it. And then I read Robert Whittaker in 2012, and that's when I came off my medicine. Reading Mad in America was a total big life change for me. Probably saved my life, actually.
Uh-huh.
I'm a big fan of his, that book. Well, and that book gave the history of psychiatry and, you know, how we had done other patients. You know, I like that it's so informative with his investigative journalist skills. You know, it was kind of like gave you a unbiased viewpoint of everything. But it also had science in it that proved what he was saying. It made me go, oh, my gosh.
So that's what I had been doing advocacy in Alaska, actually some fairly significant, but I didn't feel, and I had someone who was saying, oh, you should get involved nationally, and I didn't feel I had much to add to what these you know, great people were doing. But then when I read Mad in America, in addition to it being a great book, to me it was a litigation roadmap for how to challenge forced drugging based on it not being in the person's best interest. So I actually crashed the NARPA conference that year, National Association of Rights Protection and Advocacy. And I'd say I crashed it because it was way too late to get on the agenda to do a presentation. But I rented a room at the same time, you know, a presentation room. And I... And I passed out flyers that I was going to give this talk, and I brought, I don't know, a bunch of copies of Mad in America to give away. And
that was smart.
And then and Mind Freedom was there, David Oakes, and they were selling Mad in America, and it's like, oh, but it actually worked out great because my talk was right at the end. And everybody who could afford it bought it from Mind Freedom, and then people who couldn't afford it could come to my presentation, and I would give them a copy. So,
that's pretty good marketing. You probably didn't plan it that way, but it turned out good.
Yeah. So, and then I got to know. I mean, that was an amazing NARPA conference. Bob Whittaker was there, and Lauren Mosier was there, who a few months later testified in one of my cases, and he was amazing. And Michael Perlin was there, who's one of the judges in Anchorage, called him the icon of mental health law, and Joanne, and I got to know, you know, all three of them pretty well. And Joanne Greenberg was there, and she is the person who wrote I Never Promised You a Rose Garden. So, so that was quite a deal.
Where was that at? Was that D.C.?
I think that one was in Portland, Oregon.
Okay, I went to the one in D.C. That's the only NARPA conference I got to go to, but it was very cool.
Yeah, I haven't gone for a while. I really, you know, I have kind of problems with getting to it. But, it's normally a fabulous conference, and it's a great group of people.
So I know some of them on Facebook. I'm in that. Are you in that group for NARPA? There's a NARPA group on Facebook.
Well, I'm in the group, but I don't really look at it very much. Yeah, but I don't really look at it.
I'd share their stuff because I do look to them. So, you know, because I got to have factual stuff. So I always look to the protection and advocacies or the disability rights group for some stuff, or you, or I mean, you know, credible source, Bob, whatever. But where are you now? You're not in Alaska, are you?
I'm on Maui right now.
So that's quite a big change, isn't it?
Well, it's like if you can get a nonstop flight, it's a five and a half hour flight due south. And so I had come, you know, for, you know, vacation in the winter for decades. And then I got to the point where I'm pretty much mostly retired and we got a place here. And it's fabulous.
Nice. That's good. Good for you. I thought you said you were in Maui. I'm like, wow, that's nice. I wish I was in Maui. A friend that lives down here where I'm at, she goes to visit her friends there. She's went twice in the past 2 years. So it's beautiful to see the pictures and stuff.
Maui no ka oi. That means Maui is the best. And that's what the people who lived here before the Howleys, the white people, got here. That's what they would say. Maui is the best. Maui no ka oi. That's the way I feel.
Yes. Well, you're deserving of it. You've done so much good work. So how are you involved with psych rights now? I wasn't sure what you did with them. I know you're involved, though.
So my big work right now is with Mind Freedom, and also there's but my biggest project right now is last October there was a Mind Freedom and Rethinking Psychiatry, which is an organization they're both actually based in Oregon, put on this International Peer Respite and Soteria House Summit, and there were these five fabulous 3-hour, you know, panels, and then a follow-up one in December. And now we're trying to set up an organization to help people produce, you know, to create, advocate for, and open peer respites and soteria houses and keep them going. These are types of programs, I would say, so soteria is one of the programs that proved, it was actually a study done by Lauren Mosier, that proved you could get an 80% recovery rate. And so we just need more of those. And they're very few. And I would say Bob Whitaker, writing about it in Mad in America, is what resurrected the interest in it. And peer respites, I'm not as familiar. I actually helped or kind of founded a Soteria House, Soteria Alaska, that was there for a number of years until it closed due to insufficient funding. But peer respites, I look at them, Soteria is basically designed for people who haven't been put on the drugs yet. So that's a program to give people an 80% chance of recovery. And peer respites are more for people who've been in the system for a while, and at least that's the people who tend to use them, and on the drugs. And if they want to get off of them, then peer respites are, you know, a place that will, you know, allow that. They, you know,
you got
their
a minute
choice.
Left. I'm sorry, you have 1 minute left.
All right. Well, anyway, so that's my big project now. And I'm maybe on Maui, but I'm not on vacation.
Right. You're always working. I'm sorry for having you on the holiday. I didn't realize that till today. I'm like, oh, my gosh. So I apologize for that. But I'll share more about that to Twitter, and if anyone has any questions for Jim, just send them to me on Twitter, or you can follow him on Twitter. He's at Jim Godstein, and it's the Zyprexa Papers, and I'm Kentucky Blue Blood. Mm-hmm. And have a good night, everybody.
Thanks. It's been nice chatting with you.
Thanks, Jim. Bye-bye.